From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Mercury is a very handy element when it comes to thermometers and compact fluorescent light bulbs. But the heavy metal is toxic and not something you really want in large quantities in your wetlands and streams. Unfortunately, Utah's waterways and especially the Great Salt Lake are chock full of mercury and its even more toxic sibling, methylmercury. Studies show Great Salt Lake has the highest levels of methylmercury concentrations ever detected in the U.S., and scientists are studying the effects on the plants, insects, and birds that are part of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem. Today on the program, we're talking about where this mercury is coming from and what can be done to contain the contamination. Plus, the local effect and how mom-and-pop shops contribute to the local economy. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In 2003, scientists took water and sediment samples from the Great Salt Lake, and they discovered the highest level of mercury ever detected in the U.S. Since then, samples from fish, waterfowl, and even spiders all show the same result, extremely high mercury levels. And today on the program, we're talking about mercury and methylmercury contamination in the Great Salt Lake and the effect these toxic substances have on the birds, humans, and other creatures that live near and depend on the Great Salt Lake. Joining me this segment is Dave Nafs. He has worked as a research hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey for more than 25 years, and mercury in the Great Salt Lake is one of his main research interests. Dave joins me in studio. Dave, good morning.
Morning, Jennifer.
Also with us, Linda Freitas. She is the executive director of the Friends of Great Salt Lake, where she has volunteered since 1996. Linda Freitas, great to have you back.
Thank you.
And Jody Gardberg is the Great Salt Lake Watershed Coordinator for the Utah Department of Environmental Quality in the Division of Water Quality. She's also a statewide mercury coordinator. And Jody, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Friends of the Great Salt Lake will hold a free public pre-forum session on mercury in the lake as part of the 2012 Great Salt Lake Issues Forum. That session will be held tomorrow, Wednesday, May 9th, at the University of Utah in the Officers Club. And there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. And again, the Great Salt Lake Forum will be held on Thursday and Friday this week. Later on in the program, we're talking about the local effect of local business. But first, mercury in the Great Salt Lake. What's your hypothesis about why mercury levels are so high in the Great Salt Lake? And how do you think we should improve the mercury situation? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Linda Freitas, I want to start with you. The level of mercury in the lake is quite alarming, but the interest in mercury contamination is relatively a new concern, just started within the last decade or so. Why should the general public care about the high level of mercury in Great Salt Lake?
Well, mercury does have health implications. We know that it's a neurotoxin and it can affect both mental and physical health of humans, certainly in the unborn fetuses of pregnant mothers. Mercury can be problematic with the development of the fetus as well. But when we talk about wildlife in Great Salt Lake, and particularly waterfowl, we know that there's a very robust waterfowl tradition of hunting ducks, and certainly Great Salt Lake is the recipient of, I think it's one-third of the Pacific or Central Flyway of waterfowl that comes through that system. And as a consequence, if they're being exposed to high levels of mercury and translating that into methylmercury in their tissues, it definitely impacts the livelihood of hunting and that waterfowl tradition that's such a big part of Great Salt Lake and an economic contributor to the state of Utah.
Mm. Dave Nafs, give us a bit of chemistry 101. What exactly is this element called mercury?
Well, you know, in certain forms, you can tolerate relatively high levels of mercury, but the geochemical conditions in the Great Salt Lake facilitate the transformation of mercury into this more toxic form, this methyl mercury that you've been hearing about.
So what's the difference between mercury and methyl mercury?
Well, you know, not to get into the detailed chemistry, but it just has a the methyl mercury is more highly bioaccumulated and biomagnified. So it moves up the food chain much more readily and gets into the birds and then subsequently into hunters that harvest from the lake, things like that. And it's the geochemical conditions that are on the lake. You know, we all realize how unique geochemically the lake is, and this unique geochemistry makes it facilitates this methylation process for mercury.
So this chemical is out there in the environment. We're exposed to it. What is an acceptable level of mercury, and you know, what do the Great Salt Lake levels look like?
Yeah, I mean, for an acceptable level of methyl mercury, we're looking at you know, relatively low concentrations. This is below parts per trillion, a subpart per trillion concentration, which is extremely low. So, even very very small traces of methyl mercury in the water can have serious impacts to the biota that utilize those waters.
Mm-hmm. And so, what are we looking at in the Great Salt Lake?
In the Great Salt Lake, some of the deep brine layer samples, and this is some of the deeper water in the very deepest portions of the lake, have methyl mercury concentrations that exceed about 30 nanograms per liter, or 30 parts per trillion, which is very high. I mean, most waters will have less than one part per trillion or nanogram per liter of methyl mercury in it.
So the methyl mercury accumulates in the sediment. It's also in the water. Has this been a problem for a long time? I understand that you know, USGS and other agencies just started studying this within the last decade.
That's true, and I think that when you start looking at some of the human-induced changes that has occurred on Great Salt Lake over the past 50 years, one being this construction of the Rockfield Railroad Causeway that was completed in the mid-1950s, that's created some very unique geochemistry that makes it more conducive for methylation that probably did not exist before Great Salt Lake was segmented into a north and south half, if you will.
Mm. Jody Gardberg, I want to bring you into the conversation. What does all of this mean for the fowl, the birds that are part of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem?
Well, in 2004, they sampled 10 species of birds, and they found that the mercury concentrations, or the methyl mercury concentrations, were greater than the EPA screening value in the breast muscle tissue. And so for three species of birds, the common golden eye, the cinnamon teal, and the northern shoveler. And because the average concentrations were greater than 0.3 parts per million, they issued a waterfowl advisory on those three species of ducks, asking pregnant women and the most vulnerable group, pregnant women and children, and nursing mothers, to not eat those three species of ducks, and for adults to limit their consumption to 1 8-ounce meal per month.
Mm. So the toxicity, is it harmful to the birds themselves, or is it just something that they accumulate and pass it up the food chain and it's harmful to us as humans?
It's harmful. That's why we sampled the breast muscle tissue, because that's what we're eating. And so for the waterfowl advisories, it's breast muscle tissue. For harmful effects to birds, we look at reproduction, and we also look at the liver concentrations. And we've since sampled the waterfowl, and we've seen lower concentrations, but that doesn't mean we're not sure if they're getting the mercury at Great Salt Lake because they're migrating, or if it was laboratory issues or things like that. So we're going to resample those ducks, and we're going to try to determine are birds at risk due to mercury concentrations that they get at the Great Salt Lake.
Got it. And are people eating these ducks, and does mercury cook out of the meat by chance?
It doesn't. There's some other metals that do, and you can, for example, in fish, you can skin the fish and just get that meaty portion and the fat, but not with mercury. With mercury, you really need to limit your consumption of mercury, and just be aware and cautious of what fish or waterfowl or ducks have higher concentrations. It's usually the longer-lived, larger waterfowl or fish that have the higher concentrations because, as Dave says, it biomagnifies, meaning that larger fish eat smaller fish and they accumulate all that mercury. So it's the longer-lived, larger fish or waterfowl that will have the highest concentrations of mercury.
Speaking about mercury in the Great Salt Lake with Jody Gardberg, she is Great Salt Lake Watershed Coordinator for the Utah Division of Water Quality, also with us, Dave Nafs, a research hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and Linda Freitas, Executive Director of Friends of the Great Salt Lake. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So I guess the big question is, where is this mercury coming from? Dave Nafs, why don't you tell us about the studies that you've been conducting, others have conducted, looking into the sources of mercury contamination in the lake?
Well, one thing we know for sure, Jennifer, is that most of the mercury coming into the lake present day is from atmospheric deposition. Now, where the source of this atmospheric deposition of mercury is coming from, whether it's within the continental United States or coming in globally from, power plants in China that are pretty much unregulated, is kind of that's the $100 question.
So you're talking about acid rain, about air pollution. What do you mean by atmospheric?
Yeah, it's you can envision the lake as like this giant catcher's mitt because it has such a large surface area, but very small depth. And so here it's exposing itself directly to this atmospheric deposition that comes in from these various pollution sources, whether it's global or regional in nature.
Do we have a sense of the regional part of this? I mean, does it have to do with mining activities that are close to home, or the pollution, as you said, that's floating over from China?
Yeah, it certainly could, and this is getting into my outside of my area of expertise, but there's people, researchers at the University of Utah who'll be talking at the Mercury Forum tomorrow about, they have these continuous monitors on the lake where they're continuously sampling the atmospheric concentration of mercury, every 15 minutes, and then actually are able to backtrack when they get a high hit of mercury, do some back trajectories of where this pollution mass may be coming from. And, we're real excited to hear about some of their more recent results of, maybe being able to pin down where these sources are coming from.
Linda Freitas, I imagine your group is quite anxious to hear some of this recent research.
Oh, we are very much. And it's going to be a stellar gather of expert resources talking about mercury in various parts of the lake in various phases. So it's going to be a very exciting conversation.
Again, there is a free public lecture about mercury levels in the lake. That's happening tomorrow, May 9th, at the Fort Douglas Officers Club at the University of Utah here in Salt Lake City. Again, it's a pre-forum to the 2012 Great Salt Lake Forum, which will be held Thursday and Friday also at Fort Douglas in Salt Lake. And there's more information on our website about how to register and get more information at kcpw.org. If you've got questions or comments about mercury in the Great Salt Lake, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, it's all about mercury and how very high levels of the chemical are affecting the birds, insects, and plants that call the Great Salt Lake home and us. There is a free public lecture about mercury levels in the lake tomorrow, Wednesday, May 9th, at the Fort Douglas Officers Club at the University of Utah as part of the Great Salt Lake Forum. There's more information at kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about mercury in the Great Salt Lake, give us a call, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. 8255. Joining us this segment, Jody Gardberg is the Great Salt Lake Watershed Coordinator for the Utah Division of Water Quality, also a statewide mercury coordinator. Linda Freitas is Executive Director of the Friends of the Great Salt Lake, and Dave Nafs is a research hydrologist with the USGS. Melinda called from Salt Lake City. She couldn't stay on the line, but this is her question. Is it dangerous to humans who are around and in the lake because of those mercury levels? Why are the beaches still open and there's no warning? Who would like to take that one? Nobody. Okay. Jody Gardberg.
We are primarily exposed by consuming fish or waterfowl.
So touching that water isn't going to hurt you?
No, not that I've heard of. But we do accumulate methylmercury from consuming fish and waterfowl primarily.
Okay, so what if if there's high level of mercury in the sediment and you're walking in the Great Salt Lake and you have a cut? What about that? Is that amount to consumption, Dave Nafs?
No, I mean, you know, you could potentially, you know, get some methylmercury in that cut, but the mass that you would consume from, say, eating a 8-ounce portion of fish or a waterfowl breast muscle tissue would be orders of magnitude greater than, you know, something that might leach in through a cut. And whether or not that would be ingested, I think that, you know, I'm no physiologist by any means, but I've never seen anything in the literature where that was of any concern.
Okay. Melinda, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Glenn calling from Salt Lake City. Glenn, hi.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I'm curious if there's any way to safely remove the mercury.
Okay, it's a good question. Is there any way to remedy this problem? Dave Nafs.
Well, that's a really good question. In fact, we've got another project that's outside of the Great Salt Lake, but we're doing in cooperation with the state of Utah, where we're actually doing a mercury remediation project at a mercury contaminated reservoir in southwestern Utah. And what we're doing there is actually pumping the water. We're having some in-lake circulation that is, in essence, interrupting this methylation cycle. So we're not producing, or at least the purpose is to interrupt this methylation cycle and not produce as much methylmercury, and then it's not available for the fish to be uptaking. And this experiment or field demonstration project is it's been going on for 2 years now. It's a little too early to tell whether or not it's working, but within the next year or so, we'll have some pretty conclusive results if this is going to be a viable remediation method.
Glenn, are you, as someone who lives here, are you concerned about the levels of mercury in the Great Salt Lake?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I don't eat the waterfowl, the ducks coming off the lake, but, you know, I have a young son, and I'm just concerned about the environmental impacts and basically his overall and general health. So, yeah, it's very concerning for me.
Glenn, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Linda Freitas? I think I interrupted you.
I was just going to mention to Glenn that Dave will be talking about that very project tomorrow.
Okay, and again, this is a free public lecture tomorrow at the University of Utah. You can check out the details at kcpw.org. So we've been advised against eating the waterfowl, the ducks out on the lake. There aren't any fish in the lake, but mercury is a big problem in other waterways in the state, right, Jody Gardberg?
Right. We've been sampling Utah's waters since 2005 and at 352 sites since then. And in 18 sites, we have fish consumption advisories for mercury. And
contamination. We're not sure quite where it's coming from, but it's there.
Right. But I do want to point out that 90% of those sites have been cleaned. So that's a hopeful message. But I do want people to be aware of those 18 fish consumption advisories and be cautious. But I also want to say that eating fish is very good for you. So we like to weigh those benefits against the risk, because the benefits are it's great for your heart, and it's also good for neurological development in children. So you'll see these omega-3 fatty acids, EPA and DHA. You'll see DHA in formula for infants, because it is so good for you. So just be aware and be cautious on those 18 sites. We have a website, mercury.utah.gov, and you can get all your information from those websites. Just look at those sites and limit your consumption at those 18 sites.
So if you do consume a fish, I guess there's mercury in it. What happens to you? I mean, it would have to be at a high enough level for something, for a symptom to occur. Is that right?
Right. I mean, it's most the group that's most vulnerable is pregnant women, nursing mothers, and children, because it's expressed in the breast milk and to the fetus. And in children, they have rapid neurological development. So, you know, methylmercury can be toxic. It affects your coordination, your senses, your ability to walk and talk and see and hear. So you limit those fish that the longer live, larger fish like shark or swordfish, things that you get at the supermarket, but even in our waterways, just limit the fish that we know have high levels of mercury concentration. But I would recommend to eat fish. I mean, it is really good for you.
And of course, fish can't live in the Great Salt Lake. It's too much too salty. But there are other creatures that do. And I'm thinking of the brine flies, the brine shrimp that the Great Salt Lake is so famous for. I understand that Westminster College has been doing some research into mercury levels in spiders along the lake. What are the mercury levels among these other creatures that rely on the lake? Dave Nafs?
Yeah, I think that this this new kind of research that Westminster is leading up, where they're actually starting to look at the terrestrial cycle of mercury around the lake, and I think that's a great idea and really needed information to kind of get a complete picture of what's going on. I haven't seen any of their detailed results yet, but kind of based on hearsay, I see that they've sampled the same spiders in Utah Lake versus Great Salt Lake and have seen, you know, substantially higher concentrations in the spiders from Great Salt Lake.
If that is true, if the research bears that out, what does that mean? I mean, is it even more mercury that's going into the predators of those brine flies and the spiders, and it continues to accumulate in the larger mammals up the food chain?
Yeah, it's just another opportunity for birds to ingest mercury, the birds that utilize the spiders as a food source. You know, I should mention, though, one kind of glimmer of hope that we have in this whole issue is that, as you're probably aware, the US EPA has just recently enacted a new mercury emission regulation for power plants within the United States, where within the next 3 to 4 years, they have to eliminate 90% of their mercury emissions. So we're really excited. We've got some good baseline data on the Great Salt Lake. And as we move forward into this kind of emission reduction phase, to see if we'll actually see an ecological impact to the Great Salt Lake itself.
We're talking about mercury levels in the Great Salt Lake and the effects on the Great Salt Lake ecosystem and on us as humans. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Heidi calling from Salt Lake City. Heidi, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
Okay. I was wondering if they have, you know, the people that are measuring the mercury, are there any specific industries that, as a byproduct, produce mercury? That might be a way to find out the source, the point source. And then my other, that's a question. And then another question is the salt that's being processed from the Great Salt Lake going to be contaminated then?
Interesting questions. Heidi, thanks. So, who would like to take that? First, you know, pinpointing exactly where this is coming from. It's a difficult science, clearly. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Jody Harper? Yes, the Division of Water Quality regulates point source discharges in the lake. And there are mercury, but it's so small, it's non-detectable with our instruments. But we do have limits on those discharges. to the lake. And in the salt, not that we're aware of, but we don't test the salt. We just regulate the point source discharge.
So there's no active research into the salt that's being extracted as far as mercury levels go.
Well, we've been monitoring the water in the sediment, and that would pick up the salt, the salinity, right?
Well, and I think the advantage that we have with respect to the salt, and I think that maybe the caller is referring to some of these mineral supplements that come from the Great Salt Lake that are all actually ingested by people in terms of nutrition. And the one thing that we have going for us in that respect is that mercury is a pretty big molecule. And as these salts precipitate out, mercury is probably excluded. It's too big to fit in some of these salt structures. And so, you know, from that theoretical point of view, I wouldn't expect there to be much mercury in the supplemental salts that are taken out of it.
You know, back to contributors to atmospheric mercury emissions, regionally, I think we have identified gold ore roasting operations to the west of us in Nevada as a potential contributor because of mercury being used in the processing of the gold. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jody, but I think the state is working on a regional basis with resources in Nevada, talking about best available technological practices as it pertains to those operations and perhaps the contribution atmospherically from those operations as prevailing winds come across to Utah. Is that happening?
Well, I'll try to answer that question. My focus has been water quality, but I know that those sources have been significantly ratcheted down since this last decade. So I think we've even seen concentrations in the water in the sediment also decrease. So you can link those. But like Dave said, I mean, we could have regional, local, and international sources of mercury. So I think we're still figuring out and trying to pinpoint those sources, as Dave said, through that University of Utah study that we'll hear about tomorrow.
Heidi, a lot of question marks remain. but thank you very much for the call. Does that give you something of an answer?
Can I ask one follow-up question?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay, I was wondering, is the Great Salt Lake unique in that in the concentrations of mercury because it is it has no outlet?
Okay, the terminal lake idea that water flows into the lake, but there's nowhere for it to go. Dave Knapps, is that part of the mercury problem? It is just it's a terminal lake.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We can't get rid of the mercury from just the surface water outflow from the lake. In addition to that, some of the other elements that contribute to this methylation process that turns the mercury into the bad actor, there's also no outlet for that, and it's very rich in sulfate and organic carbon that contribute to this methylation reaction. And so it's kind of like the perfect storm, if you will, of mercury methylation in a natural system like the lake we have here.
Good question, Heidi. Thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Again, we're talking about mercury in the Great Salt Lake. I want to get back to the brine shrimp issue. I mean, harvesting the brine shrimp is big business. I mean, we send the products all over the world. Are we sort of exporting our mercury problem to other parts of this planet? Jody Gardberg.
Yeah, so far, no. The mercury concentrations are very, very low in the cysts, and those are the eggs that they send overseas. It's sort of a live feed because then they hatch out those eggs for farming, fish farming, mm-hmm. And that's aquaculture. And so far, every time we've analyzed the mercury concentration of those cysts, it's been very, very low. although we have seen some accumulation in the brine shrimp as they age, meaning as they go through their life cycle, but there's still, it goes from a low to moderate risk.
Okay. So
cysts are all right.
Not to worry about that yet. What about the plant life, the grasses, the reeds that we see along the shoreline and in the wetlands of the Great Salt Lake? Does mercury have any effect on the plants in that ecosystem? Dave Knapps?
I'm not aware, and maybe Jody can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not aware of any studies that have addressed those issues.
Okay, research out there. If you're looking for your doctoral dissertation, that might
Absolutely.
Be a possibility. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Gladys is joining us from Salt Lake City. Gladys, hi.
Hi. I have a question. We always find a way to blame somebody else for the problems we have, like the mercury right now in the lake, that involve us because, like somebody mentioned, the cycle of the food we eat eventually, I guess, will come to us. But my question is this. Is there a prevention for this new generation that is so technological oriented, you know, with the iPods and cellular phones and all these little gadgets we use at home? Is it a production that this material we use all the time also in the increase with these companies in the dump more mercury in everywhere and eventually will come to us?
Okay, Gladys, interesting question. So we've talked a little bit about the pollution coming from mining activity or from across the seas through the air. I think Gladys's question refers to our own behaviors as humans and all the gadgets that we love, you know, the iPods, the iPhones. Do those include mercury, and can that be a contributing factor to mercury levels? Dave Knapps?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to bounce that to Jody because
okay,
the state has a really good mercury recycling program that they've just initiated. Is that correct?
Jody Gardner.
Right. You can take, well, in everyday products that we use, there's mercury in those new light bulbs. And so
they're supposed to be energy efficient, right?
Right. And they are extremely energy efficient. It's just when they're done, I would turn them into these recycling centers that we have. You can drop them off at the Davis, any of the county health departments, and at the Department of Environmental Quality. Other ways that we're exposed to mercury is through dental amalgams, but they've kind of ratcheted down on the requirements for those. I'm thinking light bulbs, dental amalgams.
How about the mercury switches in cars?
Yeah, mercury switches in cars. There are some sources. The way that you're exposed to those sources are, for example, in the light bulb is the vapors that are put off. But again, it's not like when you consume fish or waterfowl.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Linda.
But I think Gladys brings up a really great point as far as how we can be more mindful as consumers.
Right.
And as consumers, how we can be more mindful as we're ready to shed a particular product and maybe upgrade, how we act responsibly, making sure that we kind of complete a cycle that isn't going to be detrimental to our environment.
Mm-hmm. Gladys, thanks for the call. Our time is short. I want to sneak in one last phone call. This is Rob calling from Pineville. Rob, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Pinedale,
sorry.
Wyoming. Well, my question is to David, and as I recall, he and David Susong and others did the ice core studies of the glaciers in the Wind River Range. And my question is, did you see in terms of mercury content as a function of age or core depth in those studies that might tell us something about the regional effect?
Okay, Rob, thanks very much. Dave Knapps.
Yeah, that's a really good question. We did an ice core in a very pristine place in the Wind River Range, just west of Pinedale or east of Pinedale, Wyoming.
And, so you're digging very, very deep and getting these ice cores.
Right. And what we saw there, we were able to recover essentially a 300-year record of atmospheric deposition, analyze those cores for mercury. And what you saw was that beginning about the 1950s, a very strong ramp up in mercury concentrations that continue to near present day. And so it kind of shows you that even in the, because it's an atmospheric deposition type of pollutant, that even in these very pristine areas such as the Continental Divide in Wyoming, we see impacts globally from this mercury contamination that is just pervasive every place.
Mm. Rob, thanks for the call. I guess my final question for you, Dave, would be, is the mercury problem one that we can solve?
Yeah, you know, I'm somewhat encouraged by the EPA ruling that for the 90% reduction in emissions from coal-fired power plants. Unfortunately, that's only in the United States. We need to get China on board, some of these developing countries where they have very limited mercury emission or emission controls in general. And, I guess it's similar to our carbon dioxide problem. I mean, it's just it's a global environment, and we need to get global cooperation in order to have measurable impacts.
Mm-hmm. Jody Gardberg, what research still needs to be done in terms of mercury in the Great Salt Lake?
We need to go a step further and analyze the things that we weren't able to do in 2008 when we did an ecosystem assessment. We want to look at more species of birds that are feeding on the brine shrimp and the brine flies. And we need to, it's very complicated to analyze Great Salt Lake because it's so salty. So we need to figure out the best methods, both laboratory and sampling, to have a good, robust study. And then once we do that, we're going to do an ecological risk assessment to see what are the adverse effects from mercury contamination in the lake.
And Linda Freitas, finally, why is raising the consciousness of mercury levels in the Great Salt Lake so important to groups like yours, Friends of the Great Salt Lake?
Well, because mercury is one indicator of other possibilities that system is confronting on a daily basis. And as we, think about mercury being a fairly sexy topic because of the public health implications, we shouldn't avoid looking at other contributors to what makes the Great Salt Lake ecosystem robust and continuing to sustain in its capacity to serve our economic interests, but also hemispherically the migratory bird and wildlife interests as well.
Linda Freitas is Executive Director of Friends of the Great Salt Lake. And Lynn, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dave Nafs is a research hydrologist with the USGS. Dave, thanks to you. And Jody Gardberg, Great Salt Lake Watershed Coordinator for the Utah Division of Water Quality. Jody, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And again, there is a free public lecture about mercury levels in the lake tomorrow, May 9th, at the Fort Douglas Officers Club at the University of Utah. It's part of the Great Salt Lake Forum, which will be held on Thursday and Friday, also at the Fort Douglas Officers Club. And there's much more information on the events and how to register on our website, kcpw.org. Or you can call Friends of Great Salt Lake, 801-583-5593. Up next, we're talking about the local effect and the economic punch of local business. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Well, the research varies by location, but studies show consistently that for every dollar you spend, more of that dollar stays in the local community if you shop at a local business than if you spend at a national chain. And today on the program, we're talking about what is called the local effect and how to help mom and pop shops thrive in a global marketplace. This segment is Professor Scott Schaefer. He is Associate Dean of Academic Affairs and a Finance Professor at the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. And Dr. Schaefer, thanks very much for your time.
Good morning.
Also with us, Nan Seymour. She is the Executive Director of Local First Utah, and she is a co-sponsor of the third annual Neighborhood Business Conference that will be discussing economic development this Thursday. Nan, great to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And again, the third annual Neighborhood Business Conference will be held on Thursday, May 10th, at the Eccles Business Building at the University of Utah. There's much more information on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, why do you buy local? And what do you want to know about the local effect? You can call us at 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Nan, I want to start with you. Local First Utah, first organized in 2005. Give us a sense of what the local business landscape looks right now, what it looks like in the state of Utah.
Yeah, I think awareness of local business and the value of spending locally is really on the rise, which we're delighted about. We have a strong movement here in Utah with a long history, and so we know that the benefits of having that public awareness campaign actually make a difference to the many excellent independent businesses that we have in Utah.
From your perspective, why does local business matter?
Wow. There are so many reasons. And one, you know, that's obviously a primary reason is the economic impact. This multiplier effect we're talking about, for every dollar spent at a local business, three times that dollar stays in the local economy. So that's, you know, that's one very strong argument that benefits everybody to keep that money here. Also, just to retain the unique character of our community. I think just there are so many reasons that are intuitive about authentic and deep relationships with neighbors, accountability, all the reasons that really are quality of life reasons, I think, are important to me and to many of the people involved in this movement.
Scott Schaefer, what does retail economics tell us about the impact of local business generally?
Local business is quite important. We've mentioned some of the numbers with regard to that. I would say also that local business can provide goods and services experience that the market demands that the big players often can't. And so if you're going to meet all of the needs of a community, you need big business. But there are a lot of things that the big corporations simply can't do. And small and local businesses can really play an important role in meeting a community's needs.
So there's that demand part of the equation. What about jobs and wages? What does the research show about that, the effect of local business?
Sure. Well, small business provides a large fraction of new jobs created in the U.S. economy. Now, that's partly because small businesses open and close more frequently than big business do. I think in our state, the importance is even greater. We don't have a lot of Fortune 500 companies located here in the state of Utah. We don't have huge employers who have corporate headquarters here. And having just gone through graduation up at the U, I can say that the local businesses are extremely important in providing access to opportunities for our young people.
Mm-hmm. Utah is considered to be a very business-friendly environment. Is Utah friendly to local businesses specifically? Nan, what do you think?
I think that yes and no, that in many ways there are initiatives that are supported. The recent internet tax bill signed by the governor that actually levels the playing field is a great example of Utah being a pro-local independent business state. Sometimes I think local business is overshadowed in the conversation, the economic conversation, maybe a little taken for granted. I think it's part of our job to raise that awareness and to understand that unless we vote with our dollar to keep these businesses here, they won't be here. And so, yeah, I think that it is a friendly state. There is also work to do.
Mm-hmm. Nan Seymour is the executive director of Local First Utah. Scott Schaefer, an associate dean of academic affairs and a finance professor at the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. We're talking about the local effect, what effect local business has on the local economy. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Scott Schaefer, we hear a lot about cities and towns sort of actively courting the big boxes, the chain stores. And cities are very excited when one of those comes to their town. Talk about the public policy surrounding local businesses and helping local businesses as well as the chain stores.
Let's see. I think it is important that cities have active development programs going on to try to bring in employers from out of state. It is definitely the case that all employers, anytime there's new business activity going on, that provides more opportunity for potential employees in the local area. I think the things that governments can do to really help small and medium-sized business are actually fairly similar to the things that help big business. You want to have a very strong workforce. That's a struggle that all businesses face, is finding capable talent. And so I think that's an important public policy consideration for businesses of all sizes.
I certainly don't want to make the chain stores the bad guys here, because they are certainly part of the mix. But, if we're talking about local business and the local effect, Nancy Moore, how do you see that, you know, where local businesses kind of fit into the big picture?
Yeah, I do want to follow up on that comment about what the city or state does to help, because the Economic Development Office at Salt Lake City is actually very proactive in offering support for neighborhood districts, grants for improving those districts. And that's part of what the conference is about. So I think we're local first, because it's not local only. We obviously really embrace this mix and diversity. We just really want to hold up that local independent part of the mix and to point out the value that's offered. But I do compliment Salt Lake City for having a forward-thinking policy and a lot of resources allocated to this effort. And in part, that's demonstrated by this conference that we're co-sponsoring with them.
Do consumers here support locally owned businesses? What's the evidence there? Any research, Nan Seymour?
You know, we're right now in the middle of a survey, an economic survey that will demonstrate and quantify the value of independent business here. We don't really have, it will be a precedent setting, because we don't have research that we can cite previously from Salt Lake City. There's a lot of national research that would address that question. We're very excited about the survey that we're doing right now with four business districts, North Temple, Sugar House, 15th, and 9th and 9th are all doing a specific study that will help kind of help that conversation at a truly local level. Mm-hmm. I think that consumers here do embrace, it's part of our culture to, I think, hold up what is unique, what is uniquely ours, to be neighborly, to be resourceful, and all of those values are demonstrated by buying locally.
Scott Schaefer, what about the national research? What is the evidence of consumers actually patronizing a local business?
It certainly varies across different consumer types. There are some people who are very sensitive to price, and if you're looking for the lowest price, you're likely going to find that at Walmart or some place like that. There are other people who have different preferences and are more willing to more likely to patronize local businesses. That really depends on the specific district. I think one thing that Nan mentions that's worth talking about is that there are definitely a lot of people who really value living in an area that's walkable, living in an area that has local businesses that are within easy access. There are many great neighborhoods in Salt Lake. There's a lot of interesting economic development going on around those ideas. I was just happened to be up in the Daybreak area the other day, and the whole idea there is to create communities that are walkable, get people out of their cars.
What about the tax implications? What kind of tax revenue stream do we see from local businesses? Do you have a sense?
I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. It's substantial and varies by community. That tax difference is one of the reasons why these multiplier effects are so different across local and big business. If profits, if you buy a book on Amazon, those profits go to Washington State. If you buy a book locally, those profits stay here and are taxed here. Those are dollars that get recycled back into the economy, as opposed to going outside the state and not coming back.
And you mentioned that this new legislation you're hoping will kind of level the playing field when you're competing not only with the big box chain down the street, but the internet retailer who knows where.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that fairness is important, and I'm really happy that it's gone the way it has in Utah. with that legislation so far. So
play the what if with me, if you would. Yeah. What if more consumers choose to shop at local businesses instead of the chains? What kind of effect are we going to see with that kind of consumer behavior?
Yeah, I have a really interesting number, actually. This is taken from a website called Independent We Stand. They have a calculator addressing this question. So this is, if every family spent an extra $10 monthly at a local business, and this addresses the multiplier effect, in Salt Lake City, so this is specifically tied to census information, over 30 million more dollars would stay in the economy. So you
30
take,
million?
Yeah, it's a big number. The numbers are astonishing. You can actually go into this website calculator and put in different communities. You could look at Provo, Logan. Most of the bigger communities in Utah are actually the census data is already collected, so you could just take that the idea of shifting part of the spending, not saying local only, just saying if we took 10%, what would happen, or if we take $10 a month, what would happen? $30 more million staying in the Salt Lake economy. So that's the economic case, I think, is very, very strong. And all of the other reasons, I think it's important to measure what matters, not just money, but quality of life, authenticity, and depth of relationship. These are all things that are addressed by this Local First movement.
Nan Seymour is Executive Director of Local First Utah, and thanks very much for your time today.
Sure.
Scott Schaefer, Associate Dean of Academic Affairs and a Finance Professor at the Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. And Professor Schaefer, thanks to you.
Great to be here.
Salt Lake City's third annual Neighborhood Business Conference will be discussing economic development on Thursday, May 10th at 7:30 a.m. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.